The Guardian.
In 1901, a German psychiatrist, Alois Alzheimer, identified the first case of what came to be known as Alzheimer's disease. His patient, Augusta Dieter, was 50 years old. She had memory loss, delusions, and bouts of disturbing behaviour. When asked to write her name in one examination, she found she had forgotten. "I've lost myself," she said. Today, more than a century later, about 30 million people worldwide live with the disease. According to some estimates, that figure is set to triple by 2050. Besides the awful toll it takes on the lives it affects, the disease imposes a heavy financial burden. In the UK alone, dementia, including Alzheimer's, costs £26 billion a year. Drug companies have spent decades and hundreds of millions of dollars on research and development into drugs for Alzheimer's, but nothing yet can stop the disease. So, why is Alzheimer's so hard to cure? I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly. With me to talk about Alzheimer's research are Dr. David Reynolds, the Chief Scientific Officer at Alzheimer's Research UK, Professor Roger Morris, a molecular neurobiologist at King's College London, and on the line we have Professor Giovanna Malucci at the University of Cambridge. David, why don't you kick us off by explaining what Alzheimer's disease is?
So Alzheimer's disease is described by a set of clinical symptoms, and then the gold standard way of diagnosing Alzheimer's disease is still to look at the brain of somebody after they've died and look for certain hallmarks called plaques and tangles actually in the brain tissue itself. But in essence, what Alzheimer's disease is about is your brain cells slowly dying off over a number of years, and that produces the symptoms of dementia, problems with thinking and memory skills, as well as other behavioural and mood changes.
And is it one single disease?
That's a really good and difficult question to answer. And I think the simple answer is no, in that there's a broad spectrum. And the umbrella term that we use for Alzheimer's disease was first worked out when we didn't have all the tools and ways of looking at the disease that we have now. So there are variations within Alzheimer's disease. And then beyond that, dementia has a number of different types of distinct diseases. But Alzheimer's is by far and away the most common.
Giovanna, can you help us understand how the disease affects people?
So David's absolutely captured the essence of what's happening, is that brain cells start to malfunction over time and then degenerate. So the disease reflects both of those aspects. And probably the earlier stages involve the malfunctioning stage, which is the classic memory loss and loss of, you know, daily ability to recall daily events, and what we call episodic memory, what's happened in the last 24 hours, because that's much more controlled by the acute processes rather than long-term memories. And then, of course, the disease progresses as you lose brain cells, and the disease becomes a much more malignant condition rather than memory loss. So you lose spatial orientation, you lose language, you lose the ability to dress, the ability to cook. Eventually, you lose day and night rhythmicity and all identity. So that part is the loss of brain cells, really. But the early part, the prodromal part, in a way, is the memory loss and those earlier symptoms. And most people are so switched on now that that's actually when they do try and get to clinic and go to their doctors.
Roger, we know people experience cognitive decline as part of normal aging. How are we supposed to tell that apart from Alzheimer's?
That's, I think, the critical question, because if we can identify the very early stages, then we have a hope that interventions will reverse the process and people will have a fairly normal life. So how do we go about doing it? If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you, actually. The ways people are trying to do it are coming at it either from longitudinal studies of people actually my age and going on, show retrospectively the clues that were there either in samples taken from the blood of various compounds or imaging, predicted accurately the onset, because before you start putting people massively on major longitudinal trials, you'd like to have some inkling that you're doing it over the right period.
David, we haven't talked about what causes the disease, but we hear a lot about the amyloid hypothesis. What is that? Is it right? Is it the idea of how this disease works? Do we at least understand what's causing it?
So the amyloid hypothesis was first put forward over 20 years ago, and it came out of the fact that we identified in very rare families who had the onset of Alzheimer's disease not in their 70s and 80s, but actually in their 30s and 40s, that they had some mutations, some defects in genes that either make amyloid itself or genes that are very closely associated with how amyloid is made. And the earliest hallmark that we can see of Alzheimer's disease, if you do brain scans for people, is build up of these amyloid proteins, these sticky masses of protein, for about 15 or 20 years before you start to see symptoms. And because that buildup is slow, and it appears to be kind of the first part of a cascade of various other things happening that then lead to the symptoms that Giovanna was talking about, the malfunctioning of your brain cells, and then ultimately to the later stages of the disease when they die.
And does the disease only affect neurons, or does it affect other cells as well?
So the disease affects the brain as a whole, and there are lots of different types of cells in your brain. The neurons are the one we talk about the most, but there's a whole load of cells that help to support your neurons called glial cells. There are also cells in your brain that are associated with your immune system to patrol for immunity issues and help to clean away waste products. And then also very important for the brain is its blood supply and how it gets oxygen and glucose into the brain. And we're appreciating much more how important the rest of the body is in terms of the impact that has on the brain and the impact it can have on the development of the disease.
Giovanna, in recent months, at least two drugs that people had high hopes for have failed in late stage trials. And I'm thinking of Eli Lilly's solanezumab and Merck's verebecostat. What went wrong?
Oh, that's a difficult question. Well, so there are various aspects to that. This is targeting the Eli Lilly antibody was targeting the A beta plaques. And while we know, you know, antibody will reduce plaques, we don't actually know that that is going to remedy what's wrong with the brain cells. So although the plaques are undoubtedly part of the disease process, it's not necessarily a given that removing them or reducing them will restore function. And that may seem illogical to people, but that's the way it is. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is probably the timing of intervention again. So I think the amyloid stage is very much a trigger stage for subsequent pathologies and subsequent things that go wrong in the cell. So if you're targeting that at the stage that other things have gone wrong, you may not be able to remedy and cure cells, even though you are reducing what seems to be the cause of the disease. It's due to the complexity of the relationship between an initial insult, shall we call it, and then the cell's subsequent response. You know, cells do try and cope with stresses, and it's often the stress response that's damaging rather than the original response. So the problem is here that a disease process isn't completely linear in terms of you may well have A beta being associated with Alzheimer's disease and almost certainly toxic at some level of the cells, the brain cells' general health and functioning. But the actual relationship of the plaque to the dying cell is not well understood. And it may be that even if you're clearing plaque, you're not dealing with what's actually damaging the cell. Now, I'm trying to sort of give you a picture that you can have let's call it a toxic insult, which mm-hmm. is the A-beta plaque. But however, the cell will try and deal with that insult in a number of ways, and not just the brain cell, not just the neuron, but also maybe the other cells. Mm. And it's actually the effect of that activation that is what's dangerous and damaging ultimately to the cell over time. And therefore, if you go in and target the plaque, you're not dealing, although you're dealing with the plaque, you're not dealing with the response that's toxic. And that's this sort of mist or fog around what's happening after A-beta is what we're all trying to work towards solving and find ways of dealing with the cell, the stress cell's response, the thing that's actually damaging the cell. Targeting the plaque itself would probably be ideal at the very beginning of the disease, but we don't get people at that stage. We get people much later.
David.
It's perhaps easiest to describe it with an analogy. It's like shutting the barn door after the horse has bolted.
Exactly.
Your initial problem was the horse in the barn, right? And those drugs can try and kind of shut that door. But once it's actually out there, as Giovanna said, you've got a wild horse on the rampage, and it can then cause all sorts of other issues that make the disease worse. And one of the biggest challenges in developing new medicines for Alzheimer's disease is finding patients at the right time to try and treat them. So I really believe that those drugs that can affect amyloid buildup, the solanezumabs and the verebecostats and others in development, could be really effective if we capture or find people at the time where they're still healthy, but that amyloid is building up in the brain. And those kind of studies are happening in those families with genetically determined Alzheimer's, because in those people, we know that they will develop the disease in their 30s and 40s. So you can find them beforehand whilst they're still healthy, treat them for a long time, and then see if it has an impact on delaying or hopefully completely preventing the onset of their disease.
Roger, both of these drugs we've been talking about, and many that failed before them, worked well in mice. Is there a problem with the mouse models in this area?
Well, mouse models always need to be taken cautiously, although I think the summary to date is that what we've seen in the mouse actually has been followed through in man. Keep in mind that, I mean, I think the biggest problem is that a mouse lives for about 3 years. Our neurons, the ones that are destroyed here, are born about 3 months before we are born, and they live for about 4 minutes longer than we do. You're asking them to live 90 years. That's one hell of an ask. I mean, I'm amazed that we're still here at that sort of age. So I suspect the biggest problems in transferring what we know from mice to man will be that our neurons are extremely robust. I think they do very well to get us where we are.
The other thing is that the mouse models aren't very good models of the disease, in that they tend to, certainly the Alzheimer's models have, despite the best efforts, the conventional ones have either modeled expressing amyloid plaque, excuse me, the A beta that we were talking about, or they've overexpressed the abnormal form of tau, which makes the tangles that David mentioned. Mm. And neither of those is Alzheimer's disease on its own, of course, because Alzheimer's has A, has both of those, and B, it has a whole clinical progression that isn't present in the mouse models. They're not useless. They're very good for some things, and they're very good particularly for the dysfunctional stage, but they really don't model the disease in a way, which is why, I mean, we can talk about this later, but actually for my studies, I've used a real mouse disease rather than a model of disease, a mouse disease that's the equivalent of a human disease, even though it's not Alzheimer's, just so that we can look at how these processes really do go from bad protein to dead brain cell.
We'll hear more about Giovanna's work in a moment. I'm just going to pause for this ad, which keeps these podcasts free for our listeners. Giovanna, you recently had promising results from two drugs that are already licensed for other conditions, trazodone hydrochloride for depression and dibenzoyl methane, a candidate cancer drug. Can you tell us about that work?
Yes, so only one of those is licensed. That's trazodone. And the other is in advanced stage clinical trials. So it won't be far from license if it's successful. But they're well developed. So the exciting aspect of this is that it's accelerated the drug development or the drug discovery phase of new treatments. And it's based on work that my lab did over the last few years, looking at what I was telling you before, the effects on the brain cells malfunctioning once they've got diseased protein or toxic proteins in them. So it's not targeting the A beta directly or any other toxic protein, because there's a number of these diseases that behave in a similar way. It's targeting how the cell tries to defend itself from this protein, the bad proteins, but that defense mechanism goes wrong and ends up harming the cell, which is why they die. And to put it simply, one of the responses, the one that we focused on, is a very ubiquitous response, very common amongst all these diseases. And when it starts to fail, a brain cell, which as Roger pointed out, in humans and in mice with advanced disease on their terms, is already very compromised probably not functioning well at the sort of making memories and storing memories. It's got a lot of stresses going, and it's got a lot of other toxic processes. In that those brain cells, what we found was that their basic rate of making essential proteins that are vital for life is compromised as part of its sort of defense mechanism. And by restoring that protein synthesis, we save the brain cells and we save their function, memories returned. And in the mice models, it's really been incredibly impressive, the protective effects on that, which just tells you that if you can keep the neurons alive, they will continue in their remarkable way to deal with stress and survive. Now, we first did that work with experimental compounds. And those are what we call proof of principle studies, because they do they work, but you can't actually use them in patients because those drugs were toxic either to the pancreas or they were so insoluble that you just couldn't give them to patients. But what the new study has found with trazodone and dibenzomethane is these are licensed drugs that are safe in humans. We use them at relevant doses to, you know, mouse equivalent doses to the humans at a similar sort of dosing regimen. And we found that those were very similarly protective without any of the toxic effects. So what it means is that we can, if you can do a well-designed clinical trial and find your target population, you'll be able to ask the question of whether this treatment in humans is going to have the same benefits or similar benefits to what we've seen in mice.
So these drugs are blocking the responses to the plaques, and those responses are part of the pathology of the disease.
They're turning them down, so the responses have got out of control. It's like a broken thermostat. The response is overcompensating, and the response itself is stressing the cell. I know it's a bit of an abstract concept. To do it really simply, I basically say that the cells run out of fuel almost, and it's like refueling them. You give them back the essential proteins that they need, and they manage very well after that, even though you haven't got rid of the misfolded protein, you haven't got rid of the plaques, you haven't got rid of the insult, but it speaks to the fact that it's actually what goes wrong after the horse has bolted that matters. So we're dealing with that stage of things.
Don't you ultimately, though, have to deal with the plaque itself? Because that will presumably keep building up. And I think you were saying earlier on that that was your original toxic insult.
I think that's right. Well, it's certainly the trigger, isn't it? Look, in an ideal world, yes. But there's another aspect to bear in mind, is that clinically you're dealing with an elderly population. And our aim in the first instance is to change the course of disease, to absolutely transform what having plaques in your brain does to you. So that you don't have this progressive disease, the loss of all faculties and loss of autonomy, and you know the sort of what we know is the end stage of Alzheimer's disease. And actually, if you rescue the brain cells' function and what we call their synapses, in particular, and allow them to have enough proteins to survive and live, you'll change disease. You'll change disease course without dealing with the plaque. And in a patient who's 80 or 75, if they can then have 5 to 10 years of independent life, that's a really significant outcome. It's not cure, it's not eliminate, it doesn't help the genetic families who, of course, are developing it in their 30s and 40s. But in terms of the global population, it's still a very potentially important intervention.
David?
The other thing to remember about treating any complicated disease is that we often use more than one medicine.
Exactly, yeah.
So if you look at patients with, say, diabetes or heart disease or cancer, they often have different medicines. One lowers blood pressure, the other helps volume of your blood and so on. So the work that Giovanna has done may be one aspect of it, and it's clearly had a very dramatic effect in mice, and hopefully we'll be able to see that in people. But then you could use, say, varibecastat or solanezumab, for example, to lower the plaque load, and that would perhaps take kind of the foot off the throttle for the disease.
Yeah.
And so as we learn more about disease and how all these processes interconnect, we'll then be much more informed to do rational, i.e., you know, well thought through combination drug trials.
I completely agree with David. I mean, it's the multi-treatment will will almost certainly be. But we're in a very unusual position in Alzheimer's in that we have absolutely nothing. So when you started treating blood pressure, you would use, say, a beta blocker, and then, of course, you add the other ACE inhibitors, and then you diet and exercise. So all of that builds on the picture. So we're beginning here. And I think, you know, in the future, we will be using anti-plaque and several other approaches to target optimizing the function of the brain cell and reducing the toxic insult. But it's a step at a time at the moment.
How long will it be before you can try these two drugs in humans? And are these two drugs likely to be the ones that might be used if they work? Or are they just giving you an idea of, okay, we need to now use this to find something more targeted, more effective at doing the job it happens to be doing?
So two questions. So how long will depend on the rate at which we can get all the approvals that are necessary for clinical trials, which generally takes sort of months, and funding, obviously, and recruitment. So imagine we started in a year. I think within a year or two, we would certainly, if we choose our population well, we'll be able to see whether or not there's an effect. So that would give us a sort of preliminary, but the design is everything, and the patient group that we select is everything, because again, like the antibody trials, if you get the wrong group, you'll get a negative result, but that doesn't mean it can't work. So we have to do that well. And the second question was, are these likely to be the drugs that we use? We don't know. Let's see how they work. Let's see how they're tolerated. In the meantime, there's lots of activity going around around drug development around this pathway and others. So that one's open to the future, really.
Roger, isn't there a difficulty with any Alzheimer's drug, any potential Alzheimer's drug, in that you're going to be giving it to people potentially for decades, and so the side effects are going to have to be very minor? And to have a big effect on a disease with such small side effects, does that really pose a problem?
It's certainly going to be a matter of judgment, and we don't know until we know. I mean, you are correct. It's a potential problem. A lot would depend on how accurately we can diagnose that someone is about to get Alzheimer's. I mean, Giovanna's right. At the moment, we're coming in too late. So there's a whole pile of unknowns there, yes.
There's plenty of precedents for giving medicines to people who aren't yet sick. The statins that lower cholesterol is a fantastic example. And when they were first made available, they were used after somebody had had a heart attack to try and reduce the chance of them having a second one. And then once that information was available, you tested them at an earlier stage before people had heart attacks and showed it could prevent it. And we're at that kind of first step with Alzheimer's treatments. And usually what we find in medicine is you have a first wave of medicines that come through that have some impact, but they're not the kind of wonder drug that patients would really love. And then second and third waves, as we understand a lot more about treating patients, the disease itself, and we've had time, because it takes 10 to 15 years from a new discovery in the lab to making a new medicine from scratch, time to develop those. And the great thing with Giovanna's work is that if trazodone or the other compound can be shown to work in patients and people living with Alzheimer's, then you can knock 5 or 10 years off that development time.
Is there any suggestion in any of this research that you might be able to reverse the problems people are experiencing with Alzheimer's? Or are we talking about slowing the progression, them not getting as bad as fast?
And there's a number of ways of looking at that. And often when you hear the newspapers talk about a treatment for Alzheimer's, they talk about a cure. There's actually very few diseases we cure. Infectious disease is probably about the only one. What you really want is a very effective treatment, which if taken early enough, you never see symptoms. So it acts like a cure. So at the early stages of the disease, where the brain cells are malfunctioning, but they're still alive, you may be able to reverse those symptoms, and then, you know, so effectively you can kind of go back up the decline. At the later stages, when the brain cells have died, at the moment we've got no way of regenerating those and getting that function back. So again, it will come down to the points that Roger and Giovanna have made about finding those patients early.
Well, Giovanna's work does demonstrate in the prion model in mice that the initial injury is one of freezing of synaptic function, not death of the neuron, and it is reversible, and reversible very quickly.
And just explain what the synaptic function, what you mean by that?
Neurons work by sending messages one to the other. So if you touch your finger at the moment, you feel that in your spinal cord, and that's passed to the brain by neurons talking to each other all the way up. The first thing that seems to be happening in the prion disease model is that neurons stop, the synapses stop functioning. So the talking to neurons between each other stops, which is, it could be due to neuronal death, but it isn't. It's actually just due to the synapses stopping functioning, and that can be reversed very quickly. So there, that one experiment from 2006, isn't it, Giovanna? says that there is hope. If we can get in early enough, then we could actually reverse some of the symptoms.
And I'll come in there, if I may. So Roger's absolutely right. And also it's very clear that the loss of synapses is what's going on in Alzheimer's disease and in human beings as well, as a very first step. And what we have seen with the drugs is so the synapses talk to each other, and what they need to make memories is to make proteins at the synapses. And what we have seen in the mice is that when you give them back the capacity to make proteins, which is our approach, they do regain memories in the mouse model. So there's an element of, if you haven't lost the brain cell, there's an element of reversibility in there. And so hope for recovery of some functions. So you would hope in an ideal world that people would improve in their ability to remember day-to-day episodes if these drugs work.
I'd love to wrap up by asking all of you, until we have an effective treatment, are there any things that you three do to reduce your risk in your daily lives?
I think the most important message for all of us is that actually the expected incidence of Alzheimer's isn't increasing as fast as predicted. I mean, of course, it's increasing globally, but not as fast. And that's because of changes in blood pressure, activity, diabetes, risk factors. So be active, do exercise, and you know, live healthily and keep your brain engaged. And I think those things are genuinely going to be protective.
What's good for your heart is good for your head. So pretty
exactly.
Much all of the things that people know about living healthily apply to keeping your brain healthy. The one other area which has been shown from a number of different studies is keeping your brain active. Now, that doesn't matter whether you do Sudoku, crosswords, you learn a new language, or you go and learn to salsa at 70. Keep your brain active. One of the things people can do is volunteer to take part in clinical research, because recruiting patients, finding the patients to do these studies is one of the most limiting, time-limiting things to progressing these studies. So people could look up Join Dementia Research online, and they can sign up whether they currently have dementia or haven't, and sign up and make themselves available for clinical research.
Roger, any final words?
Well, as the oldest person here at 69, I'm signed up for a longitudinal study, and meanwhile, I'm cramming every bit of living I can into every day.
Everyone, thank you so much. That's all we have for this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can review it and be in with a chance of featuring in our weekly podcast column, Hear Hear. Just email podcasts@theguardian.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, so get involved. We want to hear from you. Till next time, I'm Ian Sample, and the producer is Rowan Slaney. Bye-bye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian,